Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everyone. Once again, it feels like a marathon, right? Getting all this information and getting prepared. So that's probably the title of what we've been doing the past few days. Well, today, well, now we have a wonderful individual, and his name is Bob Stewart. He has, and the reason for his coming to our call today is so that he can explain more about what trusts are, including the common law trusts, and he's going to tell you exactly how, he's going to tell you a little bit about how he works with that and why he came to creating it also so that it's available for all of the people that come to him. But just briefly, and then I'm going to hand this over to Bob to tell us more about himself. But he has vast experience and knowledge, as well as experience and knowledge in the area of trusts, taxes, partnerships, LLCs. He has several companies. One of the main ones is called Master Strategist. So he's been doing this for many years. But I'd like to have Bob explain a little bit more about himself and what he does. So let's go ahead without further delay. Let's bring Bob in.
Good morning, Bob. Hi, how are you doing today?
Well, we're all great over here, and thank you so much for really coming on our call today. We find that your information is going to be very valuable for all of us. So if you can, just give us a little bit about your history, a little bit about you, and I'll go ahead and let you take over. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jane, and good morning, everybody. This is Bob Stewart. And one thing I usually start my calls is, welcome, it's March 10, 2019. And what's significant about that? Yeah, we've never been here before. So we're making new tracks in the snow, and it's going to be a great day. So this means you can leave all the past behind you, learn from it, but don't drag the baggage forward. But it's a new day. So, yeah, today's talk, we're going to talk about trust. But first, a little bit about myself. I started with two separate degrees, one in business management and the second one in computer science. And eventually I picked up a master's in business and a master's in social work. I found those very helpful in what I was doing. And so first out of college, I went into rescuing businesses. So my concentration was healthcare. So I did nursing homes first and then hospitals as a consultant in administration. And that's where it started. And then in 1980, I decided to pick up on some other aspects of taxes because I knew very little about taxes and I found out everybody around me knew very little about taxes. So we picked up on that part and then other businesses wanted my services. So we expanded beyond healthcare to other businesses and my business grew and grew. So over time, I found the magic of having LLCs and corporations, and so I developed a few of those. At one point, I had as many as 13. I've kind of pared down because it gets complex when you get so many, so I'm probably down to about 6. So, and I also have a trust. So I did an 11-night series for an individual about 8 years ago, and they wanted on corporations, but I found out that my audience that you cannot see on a call like this were mostly retired and wealthy and others and not interested in being in business. And so although they wanted corporations, we changed within a night to trust. And that's where the main focus was. And so here we are again, talk about trust. So when I did my initial research on trust, I went to a fairly large book, about 450 pages, and digesting the book, and I discovered that, there's about 101 types of trusts plus combinations of all these different types, but there's one missing. And so we'll get into that one later in the call. And so I developed that new trust, and it's been used for at least 8 years, and it's survived the scrutiny of the IRS, and it's been gone over by different attorneys and different state agencies, and it's held true. So they say that 80% of trusts fail when put to the trust. Now, that's kind of misleading because it makes it look like 80% of all trusts are put to the test, but they aren't. 80% of trusts that are put to the test fail. That means if it's put to the test, it means it's something suspicious, and then 80% of those fail. So don't be misled by the statistics. Trusts are actually pretty safe and just happy done right, preferably by an attorney, but other people can set them up, including yourself. And although I'm not an attorney, not even a CPA, I decided to get a master's in business rather than go that route. And CPA likes to be chained to a desk. Well, guess what? I'm usually chained to a desk anyway. So that's where we are in the world of trust. So the trust can be very, fairly complex. And so basically I want, not knowing who my audience is, I want to keep this on a fairly simple level. And so we'll probably do about 15 minutes of describing what trusts are, then open up for trust questions, and then we'll do a little more talking about trust and then open up for more discussion. So if you feel like you're kind of losing ground and don't understand because of a weak link in what I just described, don't feel bad because you'll get a chance to ask questions, and we'll try not to leave you behind. So first of all, a trust. The name itself means that there's a trust issue. Where are you going to park your assets so that it's separate from you and be able to trust a person that's going to manage it or whatever? So it's a trust. So once we get past that name, then we look at fictitious names. I've dealt with fictitious names for many years, and there's a purpose for a fictitious name, like a sole proprietorship or a corporation or an LLC or trust and the various other things. One is you're wanting the people to see you as something else. Like just moments ago, I saw Johnson's Plumbing drive by. There he's trying to indicate to people that he's a business. Don't know what the first name is, but it's Johnson's Plumbing. So he wants people to see him as something else, a business. Sometimes you want to share with other people, like Standard Oil years back, open up many shares to millions of people, and so millions of people could share in a corporation, and mostly risk is what they put into it. So if they invest in oil, maybe put up $5, and the most you're going to lose is that $5 instead of $5 million or $5 billion. It's important, and then you can share with other people to accomplish a purpose. Another thing is you're wanting to preserve something for other people, even after your death. That's important, like your children or maybe a spouse or maybe an ex-spouse or various, or a church, many different things. So you want to preserve for others. And maybe sometimes you want just to hide something. I've had quite a few people set up trusts so they could hide from the IRS or from creditors or family. And so once you have a trust, you've developed something that's not really you. It's something else. And so you can safely say, yeah, I don't have a house. See, the house is in a trust. So it's not you. It's parked over there. And so you can hide things. And then it brings us to the concept of, is it statutory or non-statutory? All that means is it recorded in the county courthouse or is it not? And most people don't want other people to see it, so it's non-statutory. So where's the protection there? Well, it's on a piece of paper that I draft and that you keep. And as long as you don't lose your piece of paper, and I don't lose mine, that exists, even though it's not recorded in a trust in a county courthouse. So you can see the different reasons for the trust. Then we get into all kinds. We've got grantor trusts. We have irrevocable, irrevocable, and we have let's see, I've got a list here someplace, but spendthrift trusts and generation skipping trusts. Insurance trust, charitable remainder trust, testamentary, accumulation trust, sprinkled trust. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on, and probably about 101, and now 102 because I developed my own. And so the main parts of the trust are basically who is the creator. Every trust has a creator. And so that person is called the grantor, sometimes called creator, but most often called grantor. But sometimes we have a trust that's called a non-grantor. Why is this important? Because a non-grantor has nobody that can change the rules, but the grantor can. So the trust that I developed is a non-grantor type, which means that I set it up, and as soon as we sign the papers, I resign, and now it doesn't have a person that can change it, theoretically. Now, un-theoretically, a person can make some changes because, there again, only you and I see the paper. However, in theory, it's a non-grantor. No one can change it. And many times a non-grantor becomes that way because the person dies. Well, the person that died obviously can't change the rules. And so, but he might leave some provision for the trustees. So now we get into the trustees. But first of all, before we get into trustees, the grantor does something. He transfers something of value to the trust. So that might be property. That's the most common. Sometimes things like currency, like the Canadian dollar or Chinese yuan or the Vietnamese dong or the Iraqi dinar or Brazilian real. There's all kinds of things that you can put in there that will change in value. And if you're anticipating a great change, that's a great place to park it. And so that's a piece of property. Usually you fund it with a minimum of $10, but it can be any amount. The trustee then is the person that is the manager. The manager is given instructions what to do. If you want this to go to your children, that manager decides when and where, based on the rules, what needs to happen there. The grantor can be the same as the trustee. But preferably not the same, because if it's the same person, then the state can sometimes determine that, well, it's all the same, one and the same, so therefore it doesn't exist, and they'll treat it as if it's the same as a person. So we'll get into a little bit of that in just a moment here. The beneficiaries are the people that receive the benefit of the trust. So beneficiary is kind of a word that we don't use often, but think of it as a person that benefits from this, and that's most often children, but sometimes a spouse, sometimes a church. It can be anything. And then the last thing, basically five things there that are important, is the intent. What is the intent of the trust? That's very important. Intent of the law is 90% of what's going to happen, and so it's very important that you have the intent spelled out what you want to do with this. So now, having said all this, the grantor is the person that sets it up. The trustee is it carries out the instructions, and the beneficiary is the person that receives the benefits. The grantor can be also be the trustee and can also be the beneficiary all the way down. But typically, more than half the states won't allow this because it's all the same person. But you can change this by having two beneficiaries, two trustees. You can do different variations that make it stick. So let's take a break there. Let's see where we are. Open the door for discussion, and then we can proceed from there. So, Jane, are you still
on
the air?
Yes. Thank you so much for that, Bob. So, if I understand it, primarily as far as what trusts are, is really where you put your assets. So when we're talking about this RV and all these exchanges, that's the reason why the banks are wanting people to be ready having a trust. So, yeah. And if people, and we don't know, what is the price for trust these days, apparently? You know, just give us an average of what a trust may cost.
Yeah, the ballpark. It's a very large ballpark.
Yeah.
It can range for between about $600 for just a person that just grabs some software and just stamps it out for you, to as much as $20,000 or more. And the reason for these very expensive ones is sometimes you've got multi-million dollar estates that stamp out a lot of variations and stuff. So, so mine will typically range from about 750, which I'm making available to this call, because a lot of people are getting the same information, so you won't need quite so much coaching as other people just come into it fresh. So we're offering it as low as 750, and probably go up as high as about 1250. So quite a little range there, but much cheaper than the attorneys. We just encountered some in the last couple of weeks here that had one set up for 10,000, and it's one I easily set up at the low range. And the attorney doesn't do the taxes, and we do the taxes. So we see the operation of it. We don't see just the setup, but we see the operation of what's going to happen. So we're more apt to see the dead end of different writings in there, and where the attorney just sets it up and, yeah, we should have thought of that. Yep.
Okay, so as far as, you know, let's just say I go ahead and set up a trust with you, and so it's not over and done with, right? You kind of follow whoever you assign, you know this work for. We can always ask questions, or you're going to help us to make sure that we got all of the I's and T's taken care of, so that you know, it's probably what we're looking for.
That's right.
How long does it how long does it usually take, Bob?
The trust, I set up a template, and so all we have to do is fill in the blanks. That keeps it pretty short.
Okay.
But the consultation time is what takes a lot of time, and many people that call us take 2, 3, 4, and more hours, and sometimes they call repeatedly in the next few weeks and years, and we hate to set up and charge somebody just because they called us, so we have to take this all into account, because we're not there to nickel and dime people. And also, just a reminder on this call, we're not here as an advertisement. We're just here for educational purposes. If you want us to set something, that's well and good, but we're not here to advertise.
Correct. Thank you. Okay. All right. So you guys need to kind of remember that. So it can take longer for some people. And if you've done your homework and understand exactly what trusts are and which one you want, makes it much easier and as you go forward. The other question that I have in regards to the various trusts already, I don't know if you want to bring in that new one. We talked a little bit about the grantor trust, but here's one that has come up in some of the calls is, you know, they're saying that we need to get a revocable trust when we go to the bank versus irrevocable. So what would you say in regards to that?
Okay. Now, whoever's given the information about a revocable trust, is more preferable is probably on about 85% wrong.
Revocable.
Right. Because
I'm sorry?
Because the revocable, the IRS and other agencies can dip in and make you change your rules, where the irrevocable states that, no one there to change the rules. I set up the rules when we do the trust. Master Strategist Management Trust sets up the trust and then resigns upon the setup. And so we set up the protocol, and then no one else can come in and pierce it or force you to change it.
So you would recommend the latter.
Yes,
irrevocable.
Yeah, the irrevocable is dangerous because anybody can force you to change your rules, and put enough pressure on you.
Yeah. Okay. It's, no wonder the banks want us to do that, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
That's right. Okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead. Let me bring in some people. Okay. So right now, for where we are presently with Bob, I'm going to go ahead and open your line and see what questions are out there. Okay. First person is going to be 970 ending in 3786. And just, again, let us know who you are, where you're calling from, and Bob is right here for you.
Good morning, Jane and Bob. Thanks for doing this call. This is Barbara in Colorado. And
hello, Barbara.
I just wondered, I'll just present the best that I can what I'm wanting to do, and you can give me some sense related to trust. So With my children, you know, that's obviously after our revaluation. I'm wanting to stay as anonymous as possible. What I'm going to basically be telling my children and family is that very general that I've been involved and invested in an international humanitarian foundation. That the purpose of it is to really do humanitarian endeavors around the world. So that's in essence, okay? And that through me, they have, you know, that there's access for them to be deciding on, you know, now there are funds enough to take care of them, and it's all going to be in trust. But the whole purpose of this foundation is that you have your needs met, and they're going to have all that, that they really be thinking about what now is their passion, is their divine gift that they've brought that they can offer and have the rewards and you know, all of that to invest their time and energies into. Does that make sense?
It does, because we've been down this road a lot of times.
You what?
We've been down this road a bunch of times.
Okay, That's what I want to be able to do for, you know, my children and family. And then for the humanitarian, the actual humanitarian endeavors, again, I want to, you know, how does that work where, you know, that, you know, whatever I want to get involved with or my children or family, that's separate. That's the humanitarian funds. So the family and children funds is going to be where it does supply their expenses and all of that. But again, I guess the bottom line is, how do you stay anonymous with all this, and what does that look like?
All right. Whole raft of questions there. So thanks, Barbara, from Colorado.
Yes.
One, you obviously have some money invested, particularly maybe the currency's revaluation, and you want to stay anonymous. That's why I tell people not to register with the county, because whatever you register with the county is open to the public. And so the document exists between you and me and whoever you wish to share it with, and so it stays anonymous. The children don't even see it unless you choose to open it up to them. The international charity is of interest because that may mean that maybe you're the chairman of a charitable foundation or agency, and what if you get ousted as the chairperson? What if you die? What if you become incapacitated? A whole scenario of things could happen. But you want your original intent to be carried on. That's what the trust will do for you. It is irrevocable. Nobody's going to change it, including you, except that there again, only you and I know it exists and whoever else you've chosen to share it with. So it can stay as you originally intended. It has to stay by law as intended. That's the importance of a trust or a will or other documents. They state exactly what is your will, and then they have to carry out what is your will, as long as it's not illegal.
Okay, and then you're going to talk about the difference between a common law trust in the next part?
Yes, okay. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So I guess you're just saying that's what you've stated, that I can do what I'm wanting to do, stay anonymous, and then still have my wishes carried out, and they'll be, you know, it will carry on, right?
Yes. Right. And
okay.
That's part of
thank
the magic
you,
of the trust. It just does that for you. Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Very good question. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, maybe you could iterate again one more time, Bob, because everybody has families and we've got all this wealth. Simply, how would you tell that to your family as far as, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you're now involved with an international trust, for example, a foundation or whatever, and, you know, part of it is being able to take care of all of you. And, I mean, what would you say? I mean, simply, what would you tell your children?
Yeah, good question, Jane. Obviously you can tell the children any amount that you want. You don't have to disclose the whole thing. You don't have to show the whole document. You can advise them that you do have a trust. These are the wishes of the trust. Whoever's going to carry out, who's the trustees, they're going to carry out the wishes of this trust. If it's meant for kids to receive $1,000 a month for the rest of their lives, you can tell them that and not divulge anything else. A lot of things you can tell them.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be the whole thing.
Sure, because we don't want everybody knowing that, people have millions and millions. All of a sudden, they have millions and millions of dollars that's within that trust. But you just give them, a short information, and they should be able to rather accept it. And then go from there. This is for their protection, that they'll have a trust, so that they can always. Now, I guess so. The question is that obviously family will be part of the beneficiaries of this particular trust if it's for family, and then for their needs. So as far as understanding exactly how much is in there, they don't even. It's going to be anonymous. You're still out of the picture. So that you're anonymous also, so they really don't know where it's coming from, right? Unless you tell them.
Yeah. Right, and a lot of people don't understand what a trust is anyway. All they know is it's going to magically happen, and they have no clue how.
Oh, okay. Okay. Right. Okay, well, let's go ahead to the next question that we have here. And Barbara, thank you for getting us started. That was a really good question. All right, so... our next person is 775, ending in 9099. Hello.
Hello. My name is Chris.
Hello.
My name is Forks.
Hi, Chris.
My question is what is the best common? What's the best trust? Is it a common law trust? And is it better than a 501c3?
Okay. Very good question. And where are you from, Chris?
Sparks, Reno, Nevada.
Okay, in Reno, okay. Okay, in Reno, Sparks. Okay, yeah, the best trust. Yeah, that's actually a very good question. because the best trust is whatever fits you and your needs the best. It can be a simple a living trust, living revocable trust, sometimes called a loving trust, where you might stipulate how you want to be treated in later years, like you don't want to go to a nursing home, or you do. You want to have life support, or maybe not. Different things can happen with that kind of a trust. A lot of people that I deal with, most commonly because of the Iraqi dinar and the other currencies, are the non-grantor spendthrift unit trust is the one that I developed, and which we'll cover in just a little bit here.
Okay.
That one specifically designed to be the best trust if you have investments in the currencies or insurance payouts or other multi-million dollar strategies. So, yeah. So it's
okay, that's called non-grantor...
Spendthrift Unit Trust.
Spendthrift. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I thank you very much,
okay.
And thank you so much for having this call.
Thanks, Chris from Sparks.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. All right, let's see. Let's go ahead and maybe just to take a couple more, and then we can go ahead with more information, if you will. I think people are really wanting to know more about this spendthrift trust as well. So let me see. We did. Okay. I got to find out where I left off here. All right, so let's go ahead here. 208, ending in 3651. Oh, no, wait a minute. No, that was... sorry about that. Okay, this will be 9641. 9641, 678 ending in 9641.
Hi, this is
Hello?
Beth from Georgia. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Hello.
Yeah. Okay.
Hi.
Yes.
Good afternoon. This is Pat from Georgia. I had a question. Is it necessary to have more than one trust?
Yeah, very good question. I can catch your first name.
It's Petrovna.
Petrovna. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Sounds like a lot of my clients up here, a lot of Russians up my way in. So, Petrovna. Good. Yeah, Petrovna. It's like I've got at least six different LLCs and a trust and other stuff, all for various reasons, and it's for protective reasons. You can park things, like if you have multi-million dollar estate, obviously it's going to be good to park it in different areas so you can do different things and have different trustees and different beneficiaries and so forth. A lot of protective.
Okay.
If there's something particularly damaging, like the IRS is coming after you for something, and they find out about a trust, and they find a way to break through, well, we got more over here that nobody knows about. The subjective nature of not being recorded out there helps you protect houses and property and vast accumulations of wealth, and even if they're able to tear up one because of some clause or something, it allows you to park in various other places.
Okay. So if you have, say, three currencies, would you put each one in a different trust?
Not necessarily, but it could be helpful.
Okay.
The nature of the trust that I developed is meant to not have income happening, but just to hold assets for people. And so the fact that it's not having income happening keeps it from having to be sent to the IRS.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. And also regarding that question, sometimes you want different types of trust. You might want a living trust as well as a non-grantor as well as a charitable trust and a variety of things.
And what exactly is a charitable trust?
Yeah, it's usually called a charitable remainder trust. And so you can have basically the nuts and bolts of that one is whatever remains in your estate, you can give 50% or 100% or whatever to a charity. Sometimes you want to dole it out of a certain amount per year. Sometimes you want to give it to the charity for use until you die, and then if you do die, will they keep the whole amount or will they be required to pay it back to your children? But you suppose you have $1 million on hand and you want a certain charity to be able to use that, and then they'll sometimes pay you interest or usury on that and until you die, and then they may be required to pay it back or keep it. So
okay. And one more question. As a living trust, is it just more detailed than a living will?
Yes. Wills can't own anything, but a trust can.
Uh-huh.
And so
okay.
That's really the primary differentiation there is you can do the same thing with a will. But with a trust, they can own the house. They can own all kinds of stuff.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Okay, very good. Very great questions, everyone. All right. Because I know in regards to, the living will, I know that in the hospital, working in the hospital, we're always asking patients, if they have a living will, just in case. So, but now if you have a living trust, it just covers everything. So, as far as, what do you want happen, something should happen to you, that you have that living trust. So, again, so far from what Bob is saying is that it's always advisable. It's advisable to have several trusts, in fact. Correct, Bob?
That's right. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Why don't we do this? Should I take one more or shall we just go in for more information maybe, and talk, and if you can, maybe talk about the spendthrift, non-grantor spendthrift, and maybe a little bit more about most of the people that are listening to this. I would probably say most are probably in their 50s, 60s, 70s, that area, I think, for the most part.
Okay. So Jane, let's take one more call,
because
I don't want to leave anybody behind. And
All right.
So we'll allow one more person, and then that could change the direction of what I'm going to say next.
All right. 724, ending in 1903. Hold on one second. I got to get Pat out of there. And then I'll go ahead and open up. All right. 724, ending in 1903. You're with Bob.
Hi, Bob and Jane. I'm new to this, so I'm trying to understand. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yvonne from Pennsylvania.
Hello, Yvonne.
Did you hear me? Okay, yes.
Yes.
I have sons, okay, and one is married and one has a young lady, and then I have a couple other sons that are much younger. I would like to set up trusts for all four of them. However, is there a specific name that I need to put each one under? Is it a certain type of trust? Because I want them to have full control and not the spouses or the young ladies they're with. So how would I do that?
Great question, Yvonne from Pennsylvania. Yeah, we're getting from all over the place. Your purposes can be accomplished by just one trust, because the trustee, who could be yourself or someone else, or co-trustees or successor trustees that might go down 10 generations, they can dictate who's going to get what, and it doesn't have to be evenly distributed. You can set up separate trusts, but then how are you going to manage the trustees and what happens there? So I'm an advocate of simplicity, and so probably the best fit for you is to have a single trust that doles out certain amounts for each person, and then the children can't reach up and just kind of grab whatever assets there. You still have control all the way down.
Okay, because my main concern is there's one, God forbid, I'm not sure, if they was to break up. You know how when a marriage, they break up, and then some states, they say 50%. I don't want her to get 50%. Do you understand what I'm saying? I want him to have full control. So that one, I kind of would like to set up a trust separately for him.
Okay. Yeah, and there again,
is there a specific name that I should ask whoever set them up? Whoever set the trust up, the type of trust I need. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, kind of yes and no on that one, because part of the trust that I set up is expensive. And which means that a person can't reach up and grab the assets that are allocated to a certain person. So if you have one single trust that divides it up among the kids, and you have allocated just to your son, but not to the son's wife or family, it can go just directly to him, and that's who will be the only recipient of that. No one else can. And then once it's out of the trust, then he determines what he's going to do with it there and who's going to grab it. But yeah,
It
can be dual directly.
I should make it irrevocable then, so nothing can be changed.
Right. So you can come put your knife to your throat and say, I need this changed. Nope. Nobody can. And so, irrevocable.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Good question. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And welcome. Since you're new. Okay. Wonderful. Okay. All right, Bob.
All right. So, let's go ahead and advance. We can take more questions after this. So let's get into the one that I developed, because we're already hitting on aspects of it. And so I saw the need of a trust that would have money coming into it that was non-taxed already. So almost, well, about 99.9% of the trusts that are developed usually have, well, 99.9%, the money is already taxed. Like a house that's put in there, it's already been taxed. The currency that you put in has already been taxed. Maybe put a vehicle in there or a whole variety of assets, artwork and so forth. It's already been taxed. So now you just wait for it to be divvied out. Well, what happens if there's money that has not, and you don't want it to be taxed until it is distributed? That's the part that wasn't out there, and that's what got me into this new one. So suppose you get a $1 million lottery, and it comes to you, but you want to give 50% to a charity, and you give, and you want to pay off your house, and you want to give $100,000 to each of the kids. And so by the time the money comes, the money has been taxed 50 to 55%. That amount that you want to give to charity, you can't give anymore because you've already decided to pay off your house. You've already decided, and the kids have already spent it, the $100,000 or more. And so the charity part ends up to be the government. And so you think, unfair, unfair. But, well, we got a plan for that. And so you don't want to be taxed because if you get a $1 million lottery winnings, then that will knock out your itemized deductions on your tax return. And so it doesn't matter how much you give, you won't get a deduction for it. And so just a lot of things happening there that will exclude all these dreams that you had. And so something has to be done. And so my idea came from sometimes our annuity funds, pension funds. You can park money in there like a Roth or a non-Roth, and it can grow in there and be distributed over time. So a non-Roth will, the money is not taxed, but then when it's doled out, then it will be taxed. In a Roth, the opposite happens. It's taxed now, but doesn't get taxed later. And so different effects that you want to happen there. And so basically, mine is you get $1 million. It might be from the dinar. It might be from the dong. It might be from the real, whatever. Whatever comes down won't be taxed because nobody owns it except your trust, who is a non-entity. And, well, it's an entity, but it's a non-grantor, and it's just holding the funds. And then when the money is taken out, that's when it gets taxed. But suppose you don't need the whole $1 million. Suppose all you need is $10,000. Well, the $10,000 could be taxed a whole lot lower rate than at $1 million, and it won't knock out, you know, disrupt your whole financial plan for 1 year. You can just do that over a variety of years, maybe 10 years, maybe 100 years, when you include your family, your children and their children and down the line, and just being doled out over time. It would be a whole lot less drastic as far as the tax ramifications. If you decide to give to a charity, the money comes into your into the trust. The trust gives it out to the charity rather than you. The only person that stands to be taxed is a charity, but guess what? They don't get taxed if they're set up as a 501c3. And so you can avoid it entirely by diverting it, not going to your Social Security, by going directly down to that charity who will pay no tax. That will preserve that 50% that you want to give to charity. Problem there, it just goes off that direction. So that's why mine is unique. Nobody else has anything like that. And so we call it a non-grantor because the non-grantor means it doesn't have a creator. The creator is me. The Master Strategist Management Trust sets up your trust and then resigns as soon as the documents are complete, and then all of a sudden nobody can change it. It's the same as if I just died or somebody just died, and now nobody can change it, theoretically. The spendthrift part of it means that nobody can reach up through a tailpipe and grab the assets that it thinks that are intended for somebody because there's no intention yet until the trustees decide who's going to go to. So that excludes the IRS. It excludes creditors, ex-spouses, present spouses, all kinds of different things, and so it keeps them at bay. The spendthrift has different things that it can do. It can prevent assigning debt to beneficiaries. Wouldn't that be nice if you don't in the trust you end up with $1 million debt? Now you got to send it down to the beneficiaries. See, it blocks it from that aspect too. So those two different things. The unit trust means that it's based on units rather than just separate components. So like if you have dinar, and so that kind of sets what's happening in there. And so if you decide that the kids are entitled to 100,000 units of dinar, it can be doled out in that respect. So these different concepts, it becomes very important that the intent of this is 90% of the law. And so having these different components protects your investment. That $1 million or $10 million come down your way. And now being a trust, it can operate as like any other trust, depending on what kind of instructions you put in there. But it's specifically designed to stop the taxation until someone draws it out. And one more thing about this is, and then we'll open the doors again, is if you want to take a $500,000 loan for your house, loans are not taxable. So you can take out the $500,000 as a loan with intended payments that will come back and pay off that loan, which, by the way, comes back to your own pocket, and that will not be taxed. And so it takes away the creditor, you pay to yourself, and there again, it builds up your left pocket and it preserves that wealth that you want to. So let's open the doors. There's more to that, but let's go ahead and open the door, see where we are.
Okay. All right. Let's do that. Let me see. I have someone here. I think we missed this person, two of them already, but let me go ahead and bring these two people in. So 530 ending in 9,000.
Okay, that's me.
Ending in 8,000. Yes, it's you. You are?
Teresa from Northern California.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
I have a question. Basically, I have a sovereign trust, and I've got a separate trust for each asset. And my home is in the trust, and at this time, I'm dealing with a divorce. So, you know, it's a general question as to, you know, what I can do as far as dealing with this, you know, since the title is in both my husband and my names, but the mortgage loan is in my husband's name. So do you have any feedback on that?
Yeah, so a little bit of a mess there. Okay, yes.
Yeah.
One thing is, two things concerning a house. One is the owning of the asset. The second is how much debt you have against it and who's responsible for that. So let's deal with the ownership of the home first. California, I believe, is a common
common law?
Yeah, not common law, but where you own 50% of the assets, right? So basically,
right,
you have to get your husband to sign off, give a quit claim of his part of the property, and that comes sometimes in a trade off, like he keeps the car, you keep the house, he keeps the boat, and so forth, and maybe the business that he might have, different trade offs, and so you keep his part of the house and yours, recognizing that he still owns. He still owes. Owing doesn't mean that he still owns any part of it. Once you've got control of the ownership, you can stuff it into a trust. You can also stuff your half into a trust if you wish. But it's better to put the whole thing into a trust. And then the deal about the loan is a part of the negotiation. He takes care of the loan so that you don't dig into his business. His responsibility to take care of that. Although the loaning companies will counseling and say, well, remember that this is still a secured asset. And so you just have to watch out for that. So it kind of weakens the impact a little bit, but just the same, it puts that in your ownership, realizing there's going to be a lien against it.
Yeah, that's the, I guess that's the issue. I'm familiar with the quick claim deed of transfer, and I'm not sure how to deal with this because he seems to be pushing to sell the house. So, and I'm not too crazy about that idea. And so we don't agree on the division, basically.
Yeah. So basically,
I do have it in my trust, you know, at least my 50% of ownership in terms of title is in my trust.
Yes, right. And so you can preserve there. It won't make you more airtight, but hold your guns because sometimes there are a lot of duress. And I see when I deal with divorces, I do a lot of taxes and consultations, and I found out sometimes a spouse, or, you know, especially the male, will try to force the other person just to, you know, for simplicity, just do this and sign off, and this will happen. You know, just like the old Obama law, just sign it, see what happens. It turned out to be a little bit of a disaster there. So.
Yeah. Okay. And so you deal with this type of circumstance as well, it sounds like.
Yes, we do. I've entered the arena back when I was just a student coming out of college at age 22, managed my first nursing home, and I was in the business of rescued nursing homes. My first one was supposed to close in 6 weeks. Well, in six weeks, we had 100% full, totally revamped. The corporate people were ready just to give it up. They didn't care what I spent, and so I just spent wisely, and that place is still open. After all these years, from 1979 or 72. Yeah. So all these changes. I took on a hospital next. You can imagine people's surprise when I was only 24 showing up at their door. Got myself hired by phone. They think, you are our consultant? heaven, first place. So, but we turned it around, and the next hospital, too, had 30 days in which to button it up and close it up. That hospital is still open and a very viable institution after all these years from 1979. So, I've been in the business of rescuing, and so I'm kind of on the blacklist. I hate to say it. I'm kind of on the blacklist with the legal here because I've taken the legal establishment by the horns and won time after time, and they don't like it when they shake a house of cards. And so, but I'm out there to protect people, so...
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Okay. Are you all set? Maybe this is a good time, Bob, if you can give people your information.
Oh, right. Yeah. I guess I didn't give
please.
Much information
no.
on that. You're right. Yeah, way back in 72 it kind of dates me, but I was just a child when I graduated from college, and basically because I didn't know anything, but I graduated. I had two separate degrees, one in business management and one in computer science.
Excuse me, Bob. Did mention that. No, for people who are interested in connecting with you regarding, you know, trusts or other issues that they would like to talk, you know, with you about, you know, if they want to purchase a nonprofit or want to get more information, could you tell them how to reach you in that way, like a website and your phone number, what number to call? That's what I'm at.
Okay, sure, great.
And how it would work with the sovereign trust.
Okay, good. first of all, little disclaimer, I'm not here to advertise. I'm just here for educational. But my company does a lot of trusts, a lot of LCs, corporations, you name it, and 2,000 tax returns per year. Yeah, we do a lot of stuff there. but most importantly, we're out there to help people to kind of save people oftentimes. And so my company name is that I operate under is Master Strategist Enterprises, LLC, but my tax business is Tax Strategist Enterprises LLC. The one that deals with businesses, setting corporations, is Business Strategist Enterprises LLC. And so I've got these different entities here. Probably the best way to reach me is through Master Strategist Enterprises LLC. Here in the little place of Walla Walla, Washington, you may have heard us because of the Walla Walla Suites and various other things. Otherwise, a pretty small community of probably about 30,000. And I like it because it's low-key and pretty safe, and I don't often have to lock my doors. So it's pretty nice.
Oh, beautiful.
But
nice.
How to reach me is the phone number is 509, which is the eastern side of Washington, 509-526-3898.
3898. So again, to contact Bob, you could go to his website, which is Master Strategist Enterprises. Is that on?
Well,
so if it's so, how do you do that? If I'm going on the website right now, I put in www, right?
Yeah, and then put in WallaWallaTaxService.com.
Oh, maybe you. I think you're going to need to maybe spell that out for us.
Yeah, so Walla is means water in Indian, W-A-L-L-A. And when you do it twice, that means it's plural, so water, so a place of many waters. So we've got various rivers and streams going through here. So Walla Walla.
Beautiful.
TaxService.com.
Okay, so Walla Walla Tax Services, correct?
Not services, just service.com.
Oh, service.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
service.com. Okay, let me repeat that.
Yeah, the computer world is very particular. If you get one letter wrong, and they are unforgiving. So, yeah, so Walla, W-A-L-L-A, tax, we all know how to spell that one, and service, singular, service.com.
And then your phone number again is?
509-526-3898.
Excellent. Okay, thank you.
We have a variety of email, but the best one would be 1040 is 1040, and that's about older than you and me. 1040 taxman@gmail.com.
Okay. 1040 taxman@gmail. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Good.
All right. One other, I think I had another question. Yes. So I hope that helps. And I'm going to go ahead and put you on hold now. Thank you for your question. Thank you. And good luck, you know, with getting all of that all straightened out so it works out well for everyone's best interest. And much love to you. Okay. All right. Now we'll go ahead now and perhaps some people don't understand what a sovereign trust is. So when people talk about that, Bob, can you clarify for people? Because you had not mentioned sovereign trust at all. Maybe you could explain what that might be.
All right. Yes, sovereign is kind of a scary word because it's not a wrong word. It is just scary because it comes from the realm of common law. And common law is what all law is based on. It starts there. But in common law, you've got a lot of people that wish to stay out of the courts, stay out of the legal system, and that's what makes it scary. And so good luck trying to find a lawyer or legal representative to cover what you feel are your rights. Now, these are your rights. But good luck trying to find someone that will help you represent that. And the legal system is designed to just railroad over you if you don't know what your rights are or just can't find someone to represent you. So, yeah, so I choose to go in the direction of the mainstream because I can make it stick and make it work for you rather than resorting back to common law, basically the same thing. We just have to be careful in the terminology. Sovereign, yeah, just determined that, yeah, each man is his own castle and his own sovereign, and the person that gives him his rights is God himself. But the problem is that these can be interpreted by different people. One person says, yeah, sovereign right is to own the state of Washington, where I live. And another person says, no, I'm across the street from you, I get the other half. It's up to interpretation, and that's the danger of it. Who's going to interpret what you feel is your sovereign right? So I kind of stay away from those terms. Basically, what we've got is the same thing. Trust is all built on that. A trust, different than a corporation, can be anywhere where a LLC is registered in a certain state. It could be California, it could be Washington, it could be Pennsylvania or Colorado, any of those. It's kind of restricted for movement. But a trust can move anywhere. It can go to Europe, it can go to Africa if it wishes, and still exist because it's a document. And it all hinges to the common law of that area. And common law intends to be international in flavor, otherwise you've got a chaos out there. And just move across one border from Rwanda over to Libya and or Kenya, and all of a sudden you've got a different set of circumstances. So it's intended to follow international in flavor and to keep everything out of chaos.
Okay. So my question, Bob, is you have several corporations, correct? Or you have several LLCs.
Yeah. So
we have here, we've got the trust, right? And so now you want to be able to have that. So if a trust can do everything that you've said so far, why move into creating an LLC?
Yeah,
corporation, actually. Yeah, I mean, because we're getting more into the business end of, So if you can explain that would be really helpful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the main differentiation is your intent. The trust can operate a business. It can own a business. It can do a variety of things. The LLC can own a trust. The corporation can own a trust. So basically, the LLC is set up for business purposes. It could be for rental, for managing a business of some kind, or simply just holding assets. There's holding corporations and holding LLCs. But it's best for those to be more of a trust rather than LLC. I find LLCs, after I've set up so many of them, probably about 500 in my lifetime, that there's very set rules for that with the IRS and with your local government of how it should operate.
Mm-hmm.
And so using those rules, I'm able to accomplish certain purposes. But the trust tends to be a little more non-business, where you can just simply own a house or own dinar or own other things and distribute it without going through a business atmosphere of taxation and a profit and loss and that kind of stuff. Kind of for simplicity purposes.
Okay, very good. All right, let me see if we have any more questions here. I think we're finished with questions already. I think that was quite a bit of information. Bob.
Yeah,
there was a lot of information, I think, for people to really think about, and hopefully everyone has had an opportunity to jot down some questions. I think it was very helpful for people to understand about the spendthrift. Again, so maybe just tell us, I think for our purposes presently, the spendthrift as well as the living trust, those two are probably the ones that many people will be looking at. If they're looking in terms of working with businesses as well, then you could do that also with a spendthrift, right?
Yes,
those assets into that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the spendthrift is basically just a clause of a paragraph long that just stipulates that the assets within a trust are not up for grabs. Nobody can come up through the tailpipe and grab those assets, even though they know that a certain house might be, or maybe an allocation of $1 million might be designated for a child. They can't reach up and grab that. until it actually is dispensed. And mm-hmm. so, but also the protective nature of you can't accumulate $1 million of debt and that passes on to the beneficiaries. It stops all that. So.
Okay. So, and then of course it's common law. So you're not going to have the IRS following you all over the place and having you want to change anything that's already put into the trust as far as, mm-hmm. you know, policies or procedures.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a big bullet
there. All right. Yes. So I think people have, if they have any more questions, they could call your company maybe. And if they need to kind of sort it out, but if they're already wanting to know, maybe they need to be able to go ahead and maybe research more about whatever trusts are. But if they want to know more about the Spendthrift Trust, which is a common law type trust, then they can just go ahead and give you a call. Right.
Yeah. And remember, it's all based on common law. It just that when people say common law, it just kind of raises the shackles of a lot of people thinking, okay, are you with the Montana Freeman?
Right. Okay, so it's based on common law, everybody. Okay.
Yeah, it's best
all
to
right.
stay within what is in your area because then you have less problems. You have all kinds of representation, but yeah.
And so as far as the
The thing is you want to reduce your risk out there. You want to protect your assets, not put them as a target out there.
Right. Okay. So when we go over to the banks and for those that don't have a trust yet, they want to put something together, let's say they're going to go with the irrevocable trust. Can they change that over to the Spendthrift Trust? Can you change from one to the other, or you would just have to create another one?
Actually, it can be changed because here again, we're all talking about intent.
Right.
And so we can change the wording of the trust very easily. And the IRS does not see this, by the way. When I request a identifier number, which is called the EIN, identify
mm-hmm.
number, it only discloses that what kind of trust I've set it up, but it doesn't give any details at all. And it says that it's set up by master strategist, a management
right.
trust, but they don't know that master strategist management has stepped out, and now it's a non-grantor. And so they don't know that. Well, see, a lot of protective nature there. And so I double insulated. With my
I like
there.
That.
And mine
and
itself
that's
is a non-grantor.
One.
What's that?
That's with the Spendthrift Trust. That's with the Spendthrift mm-hmm. Trust, correct?
Right.
Or
now,
is that
remember,
just...
Spendthrift is just a clause out of a bigger trust.
Okay.
There are Spendthrift Trusts that are just specifically for that purpose. This is a combination of non-grantor Spendthrift Unit Trust.
Oh, got it. Oh, okay. That makes sense now. Okay. So it's a grantor Spendthrift combination. Okay.
Right.
All right. Well, I think I don't see any more hands up. I think people need to just continue to, you know, research, talk a little bit more about this. We'll probably get, you know, some questions, you know, coming from our group. And if so, I will probably... will wish to just go ahead and have them connect with you regarding this and as far as getting involved also with setting up their trust because they're kind of at that level now where they're looking. Some have it, some do not, most do not, and need to have that information that you just shared with us today. And we love that you understand the process that we're in with the RV, also that you're all about healthcare and helping people and saving people. And so thank you all for that you do. And I'm sure that we will be in close connection again.
All right. Yeah, remember that I'd like to invest wisely too. So if you're into the NAR and have done it, it's a wise move. So. For one, its currency is not going to go away at this time. It can only go up instead of down. So,
Very good advice. All right. Thank you so much, Bob. Thank you for being on our call today. And we very much appreciate our call with you. Thank you.
All right, thank you, everyone.
We'll go ahead. Okay. So you know how to be able to reach Bob. And I'm just going to mention one more time how to be able to reach you so that they know. So again, the number to be able to reach him with regarding trust is 509-526-3898. 509-526-3898. He is in Pacific time. And the other is through his website. The website is www.wallace.com. All right, Robert or Bob, thank you once again for being here.
All right. Thanks, Jane. And Barbara and Chris and Yvonne and Tricia
oh my gosh.
I got to
wonderful. Thank you.
Right.
Yes, you do.
Thank you.
And those questions were great. Thanks everyone for being here. All right. Bye bye. Till you hear from us again. All righty. Bye.
All right. Goodbye.
Mhm. Thank you, Bob.